Welcome to Big Talk for Breeders. My name is Michael Doherty, a show jumping breeder from the west of Ireland. And in each episode, I'll bring you a new interview with a successful sport horse breeder. Thanks for checking out the podcast. Now let's get started. This is episode number 23 with Brian Duff of Broadmeadows Equestrian Centre, located near Ashburn in County Meath. In addition to owning and running an equestrian centre, Brian is also a rider, a breeder, and a HSI Level 2 coach. In this episode, we discuss the background and evolution of Broadmeadows Equestrian Centre, Brian's breeding programme, from which all the horses carry his BEC prefix. We discuss the type of horses that he likes to produce, and how he produces his horses at Broadmeadows Equestrian Centre that they can then be sent to, as he calls it, the shop window in Germany with his daughter Anna. So, just for a bit of context, you're born into a farming family.
Yeah.
Not too far away in Swords, in County Dublin, for those outside of Ireland. What was your earliest or most vivid memory of horses from your childhood?
Yeah, well, I'd no interest in horses up till the age of, I think about 9. And then my first kind of time where I kind of realised that I had an interest was, I was at Bolivar Horse Show, and I think like Tom Slattery was riding Cullimore Hill or something, and that kind of crowd, and I was there on the day, and I was walking around kind of on my own, and there was a raffle for a pony, and I went back to my dad and got a pound off him, and I put myself in the raffle for the pony, and I'd never really had an interest in a pony up to that. And then I lost, and I was kind of disappointed, and I realised maybe I might like a pony. That maybe is something. And then after, because there have always been horses around the farm, my Uncle Joe, he was a master of the hunt, and he had pointy pointers, and he kind of dabbled, he did a bit of, like, a little bit of jumping as well. Like, we used to go as children and go to the show in Malahide. There used to be a great show there. That was incredible in the back of the hotel. Okay. And you don't remember that? No, there was I think it was an old air hangar or something. It was like and they had it as an indoor arena. It was used as a riding school in the back of the thing. And they had the horse of the year show, was it? It went to Kill then. That same show was in Navan as well. But anyway, it started in Malahide. It's gone now, that actual show. And that was brilliant. We'd go there, and we're little children, and they used to have hunter classes, and then in the big classes you'd have Eddie coming in, and you'd have Paul, and you'd have Paddy Quinlan, and you'd have your man Kyle, and he'd Johnny Kyle, was it? And he had a big chestnut horse, and they used to do a 6-bar or some big jumping competitions and Grand Prix, and it was just really great. They had a bar, there was a tiny little, it was a tiny arena with kind of like seats down each side where they were all felt type of seats and stuff, and then you had a bar across something. The atmosphere was amazing, and that was, as a child, I remember seeing the horses and seeing jumping. But I still didn't have a Grawford until I kind of got into, I got a pony when I was like 9. But then we kind of were hunting, like at that stage we were kind of pony club hunting, and I still wasn't kind of really towards jumping. I looked at it, but it looked inaccessible. It looked kind of like, no, I don't think that's ever going to happen.
But I might come in there for a second, because how did you get from doing a raffle at 9 in Bolivar, not winning the raffle, and then thinking maybe this is something that I would like? What was the next step? How did you get to getting your pony?
Oh, I was in, my brother Paul was taking horse riding lessons over Malahide. I think Jock Ferry was doing kind of a clinic or something. And so he was going over with a friend of ours who was actually the local undertaker. It was Michael Rock. And the Rocks had a horse box, and they were bringing us over, or we were picking them up or something. And so I was walking around. They were all loading up, and I was just rambling around, looking over doors and being a young fella trying to kind of... And then I saw this pony. And it was like a 12-2 chestnut mare. And she turned out that she was only 4 years old and only just broken. And I went home and I decided that this was the pony for me. I said, that is that. I said, I saw a pony and will you buy it for me? And so they did. It was a couple of hundred quid. And then they brought it back and I started riding it. And I learned to ride on the long rein. It was a good time of the year because it was like September. And so the fields were still ploughed. Mm. And so my Uncle Joe put me on the long rein and we'd go out to the field. And I'd be around, I'd be behind him, and we'd be kind of cantering up the field, and I'd fall off, and I'd give them a shout, and they'd put me back on again, and I'd get going again. And so they kind of worked out how well Brian was doing by the number of times he fell off each day. And like, we'd be out having dinner, and Brian only fell off three times a day. I'd go, Brian, you're doing great. And that was kind of it. But like, you're young anyway, and when you fell on the plough, it was easy.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I did my first hunt in October. So I started in September, did my first hunt in October. And it was the pony's first hunt. And she was good. She followed everything and she just ran with the hunt. And that's when I went from there. And we kind of used to do a bit of jumping and we did the hunting, we did the pony club stuff. And I never really, we did do jumping, but we never really took a seriously. I wouldn't have been a good student. When I was a child, I was very distractible. And maybe I still am a bit. But like, I was extremely distractible at the age of 9, 10, 11, 12, 24, 16, whatever. And I wouldn't have listened to many people, as in taking instruction well, or I wouldn't have, you know, I had my own ideas on things. And so it would have been a big surprise for a lot of people in the World Junior Pony Club to see me go into it in a professional way, because they probably would have thought I was the last one, because I never really showed. I was never serious about their lectures. I used to dodge the lectures at pony camp, and we used to run around, cause trouble, and chase girls and stuff like this. And like, I wasn't really focused on the ponies.
Well, when did you get serious about it?
I was in school, and I was kind of like in school. I was kind of like not really invested in what they were teaching me, because they were teaching me stuff and I was going, I was doing it, I did it, but I used to do enough just to pass. Mm-hmm. I could make 42% or I could make 56%, but after that I was never really bothered. I could work it out. It's 5 questions, just, okay, it's 20% of questions, so you just answer so much and that's it, done. And so I was kind of heading for college or whatever, and I was thinking of like doing an ag degree. And there's ag in Dublin, there's ag in kind of like Galway. And then I was thinking about maybe doing something with the horses, but I could see no future in it. I couldn't see. And everybody was telling me, you're going to end up mucking out for the rest of life. And you'll have no money. And that's for the professionals. And so I was kind of there going, I was kind of like, yeah, maybe it's a stupid dream to have. And so I went and did a year in agricultural college. And I got the ag in Galway. And you could do a year's practical. So I went to Warrenstown Agricultural College with, I think, the Salesian Brothers or something like this, or I don't know. And I was still kind of like drifting and kind of not really, you know, at that age, you don't know where you really should go in your life. And it all came to one moment then. We actually went to a cattle insemination centre up in Mead somewhere. We all got into buses and went there for the day, and we saw the bulls and we saw the station, and they showed us the labs and how they made the straws and everything. Oh, yeah. And
Enfield, I'd say.
Is it Enfield, is it? Yeah. And it was an interesting place anyway, and so we did that, and then we got a bit of a tour of the place, and then they said, right lads, you got half an hour before we get on a bus and we go home, we'll be back for tea for 5 o'clock. I'm like, okay, fair enough. So I was kind of walking around the place, and I found myself standing in front of the best bull in the place. Okay, and I was looking at him. And a guy who I was kind of friendly with in the place was standing beside me. And he said to me, I think, 4 words that changed my life. And it was, he said, Brian, isn't he beautiful? And I looked at the bull and I thought, okay, so if it was a horse or a woman, I think I could really agree with him. But that's just not that. So I said, yeah. I said yeah to him. So I kind of lied. I said yeah. And we went our separate ways. But in him, I could see something that was not in me. And in that, he had a passion for his farming. And he saw beauty where I saw a bull. Like I didn't see what he saw.
Yeah.
And then I realized at that moment I was on the wrong track. I wasn't where I should be. And so, or I didn't have the passion to go forward. I didn't want to do that forever, for sure. And so I went home and I rang my mother that night and I said, here, Carmel, I think I need to go and try this horse thing. And I made a conscious decision at that moment that I would prefer to do something that gave me joy every day than something that just made me money. And so my passion was stronger than my greed, in a sense.
Yeah.
And but in hindsight, it's the best decision anybody can make, because I'm definitely more, I do better in life with a passion. You are more successful. I would have been a very unhappy, unsuccessful person, you know, doing something else.
Well, and if your motivation is to get rich, it's probably not wise to pursue the equine industry purely for the motive of getting rich, because
some do.
It's quite testing.
Some do, but then most, yeah. But I think it depends on, you know, for me, you need to make money in the business and you need to survive, because you need to be able to pursue your passion tomorrow as well as just today. Like, today is great, but like, and I've enjoyed today, but you still have to sustain yourself and whatever, and your place and your people who are with you, that you can make tomorrow. And then, therefore, you have to progress, because if you don't do that, then that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
there is, you know, tomorrow. It's not going to be. Because Anna came to me once when she was a little child, and Anna, I said, what were you doing in school today, Anna? And she was like 6 or 7 or 8 or something. So I was drawing. I said, oh, what have you drawn? And she said, I drew a picture of, I said, what's that? And it was her on a horse. I said, that's very good. I said, what'd you write here? And said, oh, I wrote, what we want to be when we grow up. I said, okay, so you want to write? She said, yes. And she had written, I want to be a show jumper like my daddy on it, okay? And I went, that's good, Anna. Okay, that's good. I said, can I change it? And she said, yeah, if you want. I went, okay. And so I crossed out the word like, and I wrote better on it. And I said, she said, I can be better than you. I said, Annie, you're going to have to be, because things are going to move on and it's going to get harder. So you've got to be better. Absolutely. She said, okay, great. And that was the end of that one. But the point of the story is that even now, I have to be better than me.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, that mm-hmm. you've got to keep. It's not static. That's the problem.
Yeah, the thing's moving so fast.
Yeah, it's just life, isn't it? Yeah.
So from deciding to pursue equine full time, going out, setting up your own business, when did you decide that you wanted to give the breeding a go? How did that come about?
Yeah, well, I think from an early age, I was a spectator. I used to watch. Okay, so I was riding my ponies and doing a jumping and doing a hunting and all that kind of stuff. But we used to go into Dublin every year, and we used to go to shows like Belive. I used to watch my brother jumping, and we used to do other stuff like that. And I'd watch horses, and I used to, like, I'd watch the ponies, but I used to watch the young horses, and I used to follow horses. Like, I remember being a massive fan of Leapy Lad and George Stewart, okay? And I saw him coming up through the ranks, and Francie Cairns used to jump as well around then, and you'd see them on young horses and stuff, and you'd follow their horses, you know, and you'd look at them. And I remember seeing Leapy Lad kind of go right through the years, and then I think he ended up jumping in, I think he jumped Dublin, I think he jumped the Aga Khan, and I could be wrong now, but I think he did. And this was kind of like where I kind of used to kind of get a feel or a want to see potential.
Yeah.
Okay. And when I got going in my kind of early days, because I started first and foremost, I went into the riding school. My dad had a farm, and I started the riding school. I bought a pony and started from there. And built it up from that. And that's all it was. And there were a couple of mares, maybe there was something lying around the farm, and we got a couple of mares together and we started breeding at a very early age, okay? Like I was maybe 20. And we bred for a couple of years, and I think my sister Catherine, we got involved with one, and it was like a Skyboy or something mare, and we bought that, and we bred off that. So maybe we had two or three mares, and we bred a few horses, and it kind of accumulated, and then there was a number of horses, and we absolutely bred nothing, okay? Absolutely worse than nothing. It was like terrible. Like we just bred terrible horses, okay? In the main. Now, at a certain stage, we did have my uncle bought a mare for very cheap money at one stage out of Primal. It was a mare by Primal, and she was quite a good jumper, and she jumped to a good level, and she was draft in her type, but she had blood, you know, she had good blood in her brain. And he bred off her, and he took her up to Marley Parris horse Horace. Mm-hmm. And he bred a couple of nice mares, and we had them. And they jumped well, but we just didn't have the knowledge then of how to produce them. And we did okay with them, but like it was kind of like looking back, we were like kind of like, you know, we just didn't have the knowledge of them to know how to produce them or how to market them properly. But then with one of those mares, we did actually breed, and this is kind of getting later on now. We're like, I'm heading for 30 now, you know. And I got married when I was like 28 or so. And then we moved to here when I was around 30, which was like, which was about 20 something years ago. Okay. Because I'm now 56. Okay. So this is like, say, 26 years ago. Okay. And we started taking those mares to cruising, and so now we're starting to kind of actually go a little bit more like, but the Horace blood was good, we're on the right track there, but it's just it needed that bit extra. And we did breed, I think, one horse I bred two nice horses out of them, but I really gave up on breeding, to be honest with you. I kind of gave up at that stage on breeding. I thought it's never going to happen, even though there was one or two suddenly that were kind of suddenly appeared to be okay. Oh yeah, that's right. We had a cruising mare out of her, and it was like, I tried to break it, and it was rarer, and it was dangerous, and I went, oh Jesus. And I bred one or two out of it, and then sold it for nothing to someone, and it went out to the West. And it was a strange one, because the stock, the two that we bred, one went and Keane bought one off me. He saw it jumping here one morning as a three-year-old, and he bought it on the spot. And or maybe the next day or something, it was very quick, and he sold that out to in Norway, and that was called like Tampa something or Tampa Bay or something. It was a nice brown horse with white face, but it had quirkiness about it. It could sometimes just lie down for no particular reason. It was cruisings were funny, you know. And the other one, I think, was a Smoney, and Keane bought that one as well, and I think Rachel Wise rode it for a little while, and then he sold that to Tom Byrne. Tom Byrne rode it for a while, isn't that right? From down Wexford, Tom Byrne. And then the horse got sold to America. Yeah. And it did very well in America. And actually, years later, Greg rang me and asked me, did I still have the mare? The one that used to rear him was dangerous and all that, and I just didn't have it. But it's kind of funny. The line was good, but it, like, I couldn't understand. The mare herself, and was the one that bred those ones, was actually cracked, you know, and you couldn't go near her. So I don't know. So I'd given up at that stage, and then I came back to breeding then, which was, and by default.
Roughly when or how long ago since you kind of came back and stayed back?
Okay, so I was jumping then. You see, I went then into buying horses, and I got involved with Jerry Mullins, and Jerry gave me a hand because I was going nowhere with the whole thing was like, I was static. I was kind of jumping at a certain level, and I was just going nowhere. It was stuck in a rut. And so, I'd spoken to a good few guys, professionals here in Ireland, and I was kind of saying, giving them my dilemma and kind of saying, I need to find a solution. And between them, all I could hear was, we're going to take your money, and we're going to leave you there. And that's all I could hear between all of what they said to me.
Yeah.
But when I sat down and I joined Jerry one evening, and I just knocked on his door at a show, and he said, okay, go into your class and come back to me. And I did. And he said, okay, this is the way it's going to be. And then he spoke to me for about half an hour and he changed my life. And we went off.
How? As in, like, what was it about that half an
Jerry.
Hour that changed your life? Like, so suddenly or so impactfully that you're saying that?
Well, he kind of said, he said, this is how it'll be. He said, we're going to go to Germany, we're going to buy a horse, and we're going to, I'll train you, and I'll get you the Grand Prix within a year. And he said, but you've got to do the work, are you in? And I went, I'm in. He said, there's only going to be one thing that you have to do. And I said, what's that? He said, I'll come down and I'll teach a lesson. I said, right. And he said, when I come back the next week, if I have to teach the same lesson, it's over. And I went, he said, are you agreed? I said, we're agreed. And so that's it. And he took me from, like, and a lot of it was psychological, because a lot of it was kind of like, I was kind of like, you know, doing this and doing that. But he just got me on a system, gave me a system, and took it from there. Because I was kind of like systemless, because I was dabbling in all sorts of different things, and then was just like fluffy. And he just, it got definite.
Were you more self-taught to that point?
No, like, I'd been too long on my own, kind of, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
Because I trained with Iris Kelly a bit at the start, and did my exams for AI and stuff like that. And then you're just kind of just, you know, you're just kind of on your own, doing life. Clinics and bits and pieces of this, but never, not a real, didn't have a system. Whereas Jerry gave me a system, and I've kind of used that. Of course, it's kind of like a little bit, now you develop into your own thing. But then, we bought horses and we sold some horses, and then we bought other horses. And because I had a very good horse called, that's his Green Card. He was a very good one. He did very well for me. And the first horse we got was a horse called Laika. But then the horse that changed it was a mare called Jumanji. Mm-hmm. And she was a very good mare. And I bought her in Shakamola's on one of those trips. And I was mad for her. I was just mad for her.
How old was she at the time?
6. Kind of rising 7. She jumped in Lanigan and was sitting in Shakamola's and wasn't expensive. And so I bought her. And that is, it's an unusual story. And I don't know. It's that's another story. But but there she was.
Yeah.
And and I took her, and eventually the next year I jumped her around the 140s in Hickstead as a 7-year-old for maybe one down. She jumped Dublin and jumped, got rosettes in Dublin as a 7-year-old. And then as an 8-year-old, so I was jumping 140 as a 7-year-old. And then as an 8-year-old, I was jumping 120 on her. And we thought, fuck, something's wrong. Something's wrong here. And we went and got her checked out, and she had problems with her suspensories. And the day I started breeding was the day your man Schumacher in UCD Veterinary Hospital said to me, okay, I can operate on her with the suspensory behind, or, well, she's a broodmare. And I went, I'll go broodmare. And so then we took her off and we started breeding with her. And and that was when things changed. And she actually turned out to be a very good broodmare of broodmares, rather than a broodmare herself. I had to go twice on her. So I had to kind of follow, I had to believe in it. I believe in her quality. She was incredible. She was an incredible mare. And really, really, like, she would have been a very, very good jumper, only she had this issue then with this soundness. And possibly she always had that, if you know what I mean. That's maybe why I bought her. So that's life. But that's sometimes you need, it's kind of funny how your luck is dependent on actually kind of not making the wrong move, but like something like that anyway.
Missing something.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't buy her now. No, I wouldn't.
Still became one of your, probably one, was it?
She's a
fan. One of your probably 3 foundation mares.
Pretty much.
Lines.
Yeah, the other one would be Colette B.
Yeah.
Yeah. Colette was kind of a trip to a little bit later. And again, it was in Germany. And I was, again, with Jerry. And with this time now, at this stage, rather, we went to Chocomola's. We were dealing straight with Dietmar Gugler. And we went there for a few days. And she was, it was like we tried horses and nothing was coming good. And then Dietmar said, oh, there's a girl with a horse down the road here. We just have to drive for 45 minutes. So we went. And it was Colette. And we tried her. And big, she was six again. Big kind of mare, careful and scopy enough. And lovely, brave mare. And so we bought her. And yeah, I got her home. And took me a long time, maybe 18 months to... kind of like, I don't know, just maybe gel with her, just give her, she wasn't six, so until she was eight. And I'd never won really much with her, or did much, but there was a good story because I was a good win that I did get with her. I got a very good win with her. Was out in Zagreb. We were in Zagreb, right? And we were jumping there out with the team. And I was the fifth man. I wasn't actually on the team. And the first day was a speed class, and our the team was being chefed by Tommy Wade, and it was great to get a contact with Tommy because he was a legend. And so I went out, and actually it was a great day for me because the technical delegate there was Ned Campion, and I'm related to Ned. I'm kind of like, yeah, in some way Ned is my mother's a Campion. And so she's like maybe, I think she's a cousin or she's a, there's a relationship. Not real close, but he still knows and we're still, he's maybe a first or second. My mother would be able to tell you more about the relationship is. But he knew me, he knows I'm a Duff, he knows there's a Campion there, a bit of blood. And so it was a really proud moment for me to gallop out in that ring in front of him. I enjoyed that, actually. That was really good. And maybe that spurred me on a bit. Because I belted around this class and I was going hell for leather. It was like the first speed class of the day. And Colette pulled out a good performance and I won the class. And I came back up and we did the prize giving or whatever. And I came back up to where the lads were sitting. And all Tommy Way was saying, have you ever won it on her before? And I said, no, nothing. He said, what the hell have we been doing with her for the last 18 months? And I was going up producing her. Anyway, yeah, should have just let the handbrake off or something like that. I can't remember what time it was. Something like that. Anyway, so but it was nice to be able to get that contact. And actually, another good one there was okay, this has nothing to do with it, but one of the best moments of that show was Dermot Ford giving a doing a what would you call it? He does this thing where he does a commentary of the Aintree Grand National or the Cheltenham Gold Cup. And he does Peter, he has it word for word, the whole race. Really brilliant. And the Arkle one. That was the and we were all standing there, me and Conor Swale and who was at the show? I don't know, I can't remember who else was there. And we're all shouting on the Arkle. Come on, the Arkle. That was a good time. Anyway, so that was Colette B. Mm-hmm. And we then bred off her then when we were finished with her. And because she again had a kind of an injury at the end. And I only got one foal out of her, and that was a stallion.
Armani.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I wanted to ask you about Armani. Yeah, I saw that she had only the one offspring.
Oh, I sold her then. Sorry, she went. I did sell her. She got sold then because I she was offered an injury. That was it. We took a foal off her. Then we got her back jumping and then sold her. A young rider bought Shane Carey bought her for a young rider out in Norway or Sweden or somewhere.
And you bred her to what was probably a young enough Lovello at the time.
Yeah.
Presumably because your relationship with Jerry Mullins.
Yeah, Jerry had just bought her. Bought him, and Jerry walked into the coffee shop one day with a piece of paper and said, "Could he put it on the notice board?" And it was a flyer for the horse. And I asked him, talking about it, and I said, well, "I'll use that," and that's what I did.
Because what I find really interesting with Armani, I never got to see him. And what you said before is he died as a
yeah.
as a 4-year-old.
Yeah. And broke his neck at a show.
I think what's kind of amazing with him, he has 7 recorded offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily all bred, say, by yourself. And I think maybe 2 by Samuel or Sammy McQuaid.
Yeah.
He had 2 offspring in the first year that you covered with him, and he had 5 in the second, right? Of those 5, 4 have FEI form.
Yeah.
And then you lost him.
Yeah.
That's fairly exceptional. You know, that you were just using him for yourselves, we'll say.
Yeah.
That, like, 5 offspring in a year is nothing, and that 4 of those have FEI form. Talk to me a bit about him, because aside from having a good mother and a good father,
yeah,
there was obviously something special about him.
Yeah, well, he was quite, he's always a beautiful animal. Actually, I have a picture of him as a foal there. I can show you the foal if you want to see it. There's one on the wall there. Will I get it quickly?
Well, or? We will before I go. Anyway.
Okay, all right, that's it. So Colette was there with him, and he was always a beautiful foal. And I always kind of had a dream of having a stallion. And so, yeah, I thought, this is the one. And did we try him maybe as a foal or something? Maybe we jumped him a bit, I can't remember. But we definitely tried them, say, as like yearlings or two-year-olds. And because he was in the same year, I think, as Hugo. Was it Hugo was the same year? And Hugo, like, was exceptional on the loose as a young horse. And Armani, like, when we saw it too, it was just incredible, you know? But Hugo's lines weren't, like, the other guy was always the stallion. His lines were always the what I would have thought would have been first.
Yeah.
And then when he was 3, maybe, I think I started using him to breed. Yeah, it had to be. Because we did that, and then as four, we did those other mares, and he died. He died maybe, he was qualified for Dublin, and he died then in the July, before the show in August. What was the question again?
Oh no, I was just wondering about him as an individual. That's
what was he like? Well, yeah, no.
Because I think that's amazing to have a stallion that got so little opportunities to breed, was only used really in-house.
Yeah.
But his strike rate is good. And also, say for instance, 4 of the 5 in that year said he died halfway through his 4-year-old year.
Yeah.
So he didn't get much chance to
cover
a lot. And say 5 resulting from that year, 4 of FEI form. But of his 7 offspring, like a few of those went breeding. Because some of you have some Armani, say, daughters through
your breeding program. Well, Alter Ego is directly him.
Directly by him.
She's Armani, yeah. She's his best, and she's directly Jumanji. She's Armani Jumanji. Yeah, so that's the double hit for me as a as a kind of like from my foundation mares.
There was one other said this from what I can see looking at your lines is there's one other mare that or one other say
go on.
Family that's coming through. And it's the Drumagoland one.
Yeah.
And you have 2 Louis Dan full sisters out of Drumagoland Elegance.
Yeah.
Did you have her here or did you buy those? And also, she has no recorded pedigree, but I'm wondering, do you know what it was or what it's supposed to be?
I think it's Spring Elegance, actually.
I wondered what the Elegance was it.
Okay, so Sammy and myself developed a relationship during the in the recession, if you want to call it that. And I was, like, in the middle of the recession, and I was stone flat broke. But I was, we were doing a first aid course here in Broadmeadows, and Robert Murdy was here. He's a guy who rides up in Cavan. I don't know if you know Robert. And I said, I was just telling him, and I said, it's the kind of time where if the lad's giving away horses, you never know, maybe there'd be somebody, if you ever heard somebody doing something. And he said, I actually do know of a man who wants to get out of some horses. I said, okay, well, sure, maybe connect me up. And it turned out to be Sammy. So I went up to Sammy, I went into his, and Sammy is a pig farmer,
okay.
And he's got lots of pigs. And he has also this kind of place where he has his horse in a little indoor arena and that. And we went in, we looked at the horses, and he jumped a few over kind of like a barrel kind of thing, and there's bits and pieces of different things, and we said okay, and I said, well, they're nice horses, and he kind of said, well, for this and whatever, and I said, well, okay, but I don't have any money to give you, I said, can we work something out? And he said, yeah, that's sure. When you get your money, we'll do it. I went, okay. And so I got the truck and we just load them all up. But he said, no, I think he said you have to take them all. I'm not sure. He said you have to take the ones you don't like as well. Whatever. So I went, okay. So yeah. That was the thing. Okay. So we threw them all in the truck and I went and did it. And I can't remember exactly which load that was because there was a couple of loads happened. But we got some sold and I came back and I paid them. And there was definitely two loads of horses. And in that load of horses, one of them was Drummer Gold and Louis Dam, the little small mare. And Anna went to Dublin on her as a 5-year-old, qualified for Dublin. But then the little mare fell over a gate or something and injured herself and didn't get to Dublin. And actually never really jumped again. Like she, but she's a little crack. She's bred me. One of her good ones is Anna has one out there now in Germany called
Infrared.
No, this would be Infrared is out of a different mother. That's I'll get that one in a minute. But this was the Kinsey horse. What's he called? I can't remember. Anyway, so and I've had
Red Arrow.
Yeah, you know my brother. How can you remember my horse and I can't? Red Arrow. And he's got, like, she just breeds, everything's a jumper out of her. She just breeds jumpers. And they all have the same type, back end, really good jumpers. But, and in that group, the best horse that we got out of it was one called Hashtag. And she was Louis Dam Touchdown. And so I jumped her into 4-year-olds and I did a deal with Billy Toomey and he kind of took half her. And then I think Louise Sewell rode her for a while. And eventually we sold her off to America or whatever. And that was a very successful, really successful run for me. Because like I went down to Mill Street with 3 horses and one was Lorenzo and one was Hashtag and there was another fella as well, Spencer. And like Spencer's jumping out in China now, so he didn't do too bad for himself. And the other two are Hashtag went jumped all over Europe. I don't know what she's doing now, but she did a lot anyway. And of course Lorenzo.
Yeah.
I was very lucky on the China one, okay, because your man was that horse was hardy like crazy, right? And I got a call off Mark Bulger said, "And we've got these people from China want to buy your horse, and they're from Mongolia." And I said, okay, grand, that's fine.
Yeah,
okay.
I was involved in that.
Were you? The Mongolia thing, yeah?
Yeah, when we did the viewings down in Emerald. In the Emerald.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, I was first man up that day, right? And I got there first. And I said, okay, Mark said, do you want to be first? I said, I'll go first, yeah. And I got there, he said 10 o'clock. So I knew the horse was tough. And I knew Emerald was really bright and whatever, and very kind of like bright type of place. I knew he wouldn't like it. But it kind of worked to my advantage. So I got in there. And the only person there when I arrived was the interpreter. And there was a rodeo for about the first 10, 15 minutes, okay? And then eventually the horse settled down. Hope the Mongolians aren't listening to this. But they won't mind. I don't think they'll care. Because when they arrived, the horse had settled down. And he rode around very well. And they got up on him. And they loved him because they're tough men. They liked a bit of a challenge.
They were decent riders, I think. From
they that were. Mm-hmm. But they wanted something that was a bit kind of rough and tough and hard to ride. And I went, these are my perfect men. And so I asked them, think 9,000 euro. And it was the cheapest money they'd been asked for a horse all weekend. So they just bought it straight away. I think they said 8.5. So I don't know. I can't remember what the exact deal. And it was my luckiest moment to get that fellow away. And then China, there's no coming back. It was just gone. That was great. And I would have sold him to anybody. But they probably enjoyed him because they wanted something that was a bit tough, you know. So there's someone for everyone. That was him. Anyway, that was Spencer. But the Hashtag was the best. And so going back to Sammy, we kind of forged a relation. But when Sammy, like when he saw that I did well and he still had good stock, he didn't. Then we started kind of forming more partnerships. And he wasn't just giving them to me anymore. I wasn't getting away with that. And so now we kind of have like, he'd give me a horse and then we share it. And so I have the main mare that he's given me is the Drum of Golan girl. Yeah. And she's like, she's Louis Dam as well. She's the same type of Louis Dam, only she's like, She's the other one, Drummer Golan Louisdown herself, is like 15-2. This one is like a big, strong 16-3 strong type of mare. And she hasn't been, the other little mare is prolific, but this one, we find it hard to get her in full. Hence, we used an ICSI on her once, and we still only got one. We flushed only one embryo, is that right? And, but luckily it took. So we have a beautiful, beautiful emerald foal down there now at the moment, or it's a yearling foal, I think. And so we remain to be seen on them, but they have quality, they've got heart, and there's something special about them. They just give you jumpers, you know, that's for sure. There's no doubt about it. Everything that comes out of them is a jumper, you know.
And you have another stallion in the yard that I haven't seen in person, but
is a horse called Business Done. He's by Cannon, and he's out of Alter Ego. And so far, he's done nothing. And I've used him, and I really like him. But, like, he was okay as a four-year-old, but then he was kind of lame. He had a problem with a foot. And then last year, he came slowly. And at the end of the year, he was, like, empty and wasn't jumping well at all. But he had covered a few, but only a couple, like... He'd covered two mares and got two covers and got two in full.
Yeah.
And that was cool. I've been putting him to slightly blooder mares.
Yeah. Well, I just saw one picture of him and you'd expect that that's what
that's I what I did.
Yeah.
And but recently I've been jumping him. I've just got him back in and he feels great. He feels really scopy and feels really kind of blood. And so at the moment, I don't like to talk about him. But we'll see. I don't know. He's a really, really nice horse. But is he a top one? I don't know. Yeah. I don't love him as much as I loved Armani. But then I'm a little bit older as well. I'm falling in love less easy these days. But Armani, I was just like, I was just in love with him. That's for sure. This one, we'll see. Sometimes the one that's slower turns out to be the better one. And he stamps the man. I've got stock down there by him. And they're all this beautiful stamp. And so they're really lovely types. And if they have his temperament, which is really good, then I think they're going to be very commercial. Yeah, that's really... And that's really at the end of the day. Because for me to survive, it's on the averages. It's those other horses, those ones that you can sell that'll be for the junior or for the young rider or for the amateur. Or they're the ones that we can capitalize on. They're the ones where really that's what keeps the lights on.
And actually, just on that, when you started, say, breeding consistently,
yeah,
when you made a decision that you were going breeding and you were breeding a few foals every year, did you have a clear kind of goal or ambition with the breeding when you were starting with that?
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, I think I made a definite change. There was a coach in here one day and he was doing a clinic or something. And he kind of came to me and he said to me, "You know, Brian, it's a very underused facility you have here." And I went, "Yeah, okay, that's interesting to think that." And I think he was really talking about the buildings and thinking it could be more of a show venue. But I looked at that and I didn't see that was either a direction I wanted to go in or that there was a mad potential for that because I thought it would take too much investment, more investment than I'd already put in. But I did get his point, and I looked at it and I said, "Yeah, you have all this land, and you have all this like this farm. That's where the potential is, and that's where the underusage is."
Yeah.
And it was at that moment I kind of made the plan of that the best way to make the facility work was to utilize it and to develop the stocking of it, to stock it up, and so. And that really is the boundary of as to how far I want to go. Because I've been to like places like, say, I don't know, you've been to some yards. Now, I know maybe they have horses all over the place. But I've been to yards like, say, Paul Hendricks's. And it's not that many stables. Like, it's whatever it is. I don't know, maybe 40, 50, 60. I don't know what it is. But it's doable. It looks like a well-run unit. And so, really, and I looked at it, I said, I don't need millions of stables. I just need enough stables. You just need good horses in those stables. You don't need... 100 stables, 20 stables or 40 stables with good horses, that's what you need. And so that became my focus, was to have, like, here we farm 90 acres. So 90 acres is like you don't need more than 80 or 90 stock with 30 or 40 stables and make that work. It's a funnel. And have a horse box that only has 6 or 8 parts or sections in it.
Yeah.
And so it gets harder and harder and harder to get to the show. And so they have to be kind of better and better and better. So that's the idea. And that's a simple one.
And actually, what does, because I think this is an important one, what does better mean for you? What are you looking for? What makes them worthy of the stable, and what makes them worthy of getting in the truck to go to the show?
Okay.
For you. And we'll do two, sorry to cut in, but we'll do, what were you looking for at the time? And is that still the same now?
Yeah, I think I breed from a passionate kind of way, in that I breed for horses that I want to have contact with myself. Okay? So that's why I breed Chodromers. And I'm only to breed Chodromers. Now, if I happen to, on the off chance, breed an eventer, I always keep my eye open that maybe there's an eventer there somewhere or something else. And I'll go, okay, yeah, but I'll sell that on, or I'll do something with it. Okay? And we have bred eventers. I sold one to Carol G that went off to be an eventer eventually. And but it wouldn't have my biggest interests.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go off and start eventing it. So that's the first thing I brought. And then when I go looking at stallions, and when I start deciding on what to use with my mares, I try to get something that will complement them. But also I try to breed to horses that I wouldn't necessarily have a chance of owning, riding, or having a part of their life. So if I see a stallion that I'd love to have, I put that, or a mare, a stallion particularly with a mare line. Like I use Poker to Mariposa because the mare lines are mental. Mm-hmm. And I use Vagabond because the mare lines are just crazy. Like they're just incredible. Like you're going back to Narcotic and this kind of crack, you know. And you're kind of saying, well, like that's like, and even using Comme il Faut, like you're looking at Retina. I said, like, where, like, I've got Retina on the farm, she's there. I've got Narcotic on the farm, I've got whatever, and I've got these mare lines.
Florida Mariposa,
it's coming cheap, like, it's coming for $1,000, and you can just put it into your sock and it's there. And so, like, that's going to come out. And so, you don't have to go and spend millions at the sales, you just put one of yours into it. And if your stock is good enough in the first place, well, then it'll grow, it'll. It's like putting fertilizer on your land, maybe. I don't know. So that's the way I rationale stuff in the breeding. And for me then, I don't, at the moment, I do very little trying of them as foals. I haven't jumped the foals for a while now, and I don't bother. And I kind of look at them, and if I like what I see in the stable or trotting around the field, then I'm okay with it.
What won't you forgive? Say, I know a lot of the horses here.
Quite forgiving, actually. But
you don't, as far as I'm aware, like you don't do the auctions. You don't try and sell foals. You're not trying to bring 3-year-olds out to public auctions. It's breed to produce.
Yeah, solely.
So that gap, or that space between hitting the ground and
See, it's easy spot the horse that's good. It's not easy spot the one that's like the big awkward one, and it's like shows nothing, and it's empty.
That's kind of what I'm looking for. Like,
it's empty. I don't bother with those ones. I have a few small ones as well still, and I find it hard to judge them. I'm not a good judge of horses at foals and years and all this kind of crack. So I don't look, if they look okay and they're fine. And even like I have a couple of ones. We had an occasion where we cut the colts late, and they got at some of the other fillies. So we'd had some crazy breedings going on out there, and from some of the covers were bad. Like it was just the wrong one cover, the wrong one. But then I've got fillies, so I'm going to use those ones as recipients or something, or we'll do something with them. And I have a riding school, and I have clients there, and we very rarely use. I've never even put anything in the riding school, but it's still there if you had one that just was no good and had a nice little temperament and you could stick it in. And so I kind of also take it kind of like not a responsibility, but like I like to try and see that my stock get their best shot, and I tend to then get them to now 3-year-old and break 2-year-old. I bring them a 2-year-old mm-hmm. and I do 4 weeks with them.
Okay.
And I get a sense of them then.
And what are you doing for
the
last 4 weeks?
The first week, you handle them.
Yeah.
The second week, you start lunging and you attack them. The third week, you back them. And the fourth week, then you ride them. And so you just might walk them and do a little trot on the circle. And I get a feel of their what they are and their quality. And that's really a decision then. I kind of look at them. And if I kind of believe in them, then I'm happy. If I start to doubt them, or I see a lack of something, you know, mm-hmm. Then I kind of think, oh, well, this might be plan B. And or maybe they'll be for... They would be maybe for someone who will be for maybe hunting or for, you know, pony club or for... Yeah. And we'll find that route for them.
Repurpose them, yeah.
Yeah. And then normally at 3, I'll have a fairly good idea about them. But we tend with most of them, because I breed very much off mares I believe in the first place, I tend only to sell them then, like, say, the ones that I think are going to be not quite, what's the word, that I'm going to find it hard to market them in a particular way.
Yeah.
As they go forward, and that they won't pay their way, really. And then they will be, they've moved on. I'd normally go to Calvin or somewhere for and let them sell. And there's always a good market for those horses. And there's plenty of people out there who want to buy a nice horse who'll do like a 120 or do a 110 or a dressage or hunting or whatever it's going to be.
I wanted to ask you actually, just on the stallion side of things. So you've had Armani, you have business done, you've had stallions here for other people in the past. Is the stallion side of things an area that you would like to grow or develop here? Is that something of interest to you, or?
Yeah, no, not really. I don't see myself becoming like a stallion hub kind of thing. I think it's a different job. I think it's we're more for producing and going to the sport, and the way that the, because like as we were talking earlier on, we're saying about like sometimes things are within your you can kind of like, what's the word, kind of like plan things, and some things you can't. So the way Anna's developed in her business and the way I've developed my business, now it's turned out that I've got this kind of business where I'm kind of the factory and we're breeding and producing them. Mm-hmm. And Anna's definitely the shop front. And she's got a job. She's got a place in Fungstad, and she works at a yard called Gettstedt Prinzenberg. And it's kind of a hub for show jumpers because there's, who's based? There's David Ville, there's Sophie Hinners, and there's, what's the man's name? Richard Vogel. And then Anna's there as well. Okay? And they have their part and she has hers. Now, it's not their main base, but they are all there. And so it's a real kind of like place where there's a kind of action going on and people are talking to people. And so now that's the direction of where the business is going. And I don't think... To go into the styling thing, it would need investment, and I'd need to kind of really focus on it, and then either partner up with somebody or do something. At a certain stage, I did look at it. I did think about it, because when the styling company left here, there was an opportunity maybe to do something then, and I did investigate that, but it came to nothing, and I've decided to let it go and to stay focused on my strengths rather than drifting off to some other place. Now, if say business done turned out to be a really good stallion, well, you could, I don't know, you could take straws off them, or you could do something like that, or you could sell them to somebody, or you could do something with them. But I don't think I'm going to have a stallion standing here now.
Okay.
If you're looking for where the business has moved to from, is that, like, when I was younger, I only wanted to see the horse that cracked, okay? I only wanted to see the Lorenzo. But now I'm waiting longer to see what qualities each horse has, and are those qualities going to be able to go to different places, because the market is in a way that I'm breeding off horses that should all be, they're show jumpers. And so they should all be show jumpers of some level, okay? Yeah. And most of them are turning out to be that. The odd one isn't. But then my job is to try and find, if I can find, like, with Anna there, there's lots of options there from with clients for different types of horses that won't necessarily, you're never going to hear of, you're never going to, you're not, they're not going to be jumping around the global championships or anything like that. They'll be doing other work. And a lot of it is now for America. That's really, that's where, if you can find horses for those markets out there. And those horses are a lot about temperament and a lot about, I suppose, they have to have scope, but a lot about temperament. And if you can find those horses in your, that's where, so in other words, you might see me spending a lot more longer on horses that you might see me spending as long on before. And they might be a little bit more like, I'm not gonna say normal, but like they might be more, yeah, not so all the flat.
Mm-hmm.
But those horses could well gross more than the other horses in time.
And between those observations or realizations, and then the development of Anna's business in Germany, has that changed how you breed?
I wouldn't say it's changed how I breed, but it's changed how I assess what I breed. And it's a change, and it's made me more, well, here you go. It's made me more confident, maybe, or maybe more focused on the development of the horses in a sustainable way, in a way that will be right for them. Because when I was younger, I felt pressured by myself, but also maybe, I don't know, by maybe looking over the hedge at everybody else. Oh, they're going to the qualifiers. I have to go to the qualifiers. Oh, they're in Dublin. If I don't get to Dublin, you know,
you'd be shunned.
Obviously, the horse is no good.
Yeah.
Whereas now, if I feel it's on, I'll do it. And if I feel it's the right thing for the horse, I'll do it. And we will be at the quarry. We will be there. But I'm not that focused. The focus is more further, and the focus is more is a little bit more the production of the whole team. And the outcome is more sure than before, where you're more unsure and hoping for the result. And the result, it is very important to get results, but I can do that in time. And it doesn't have to be in Dublin. We can do that. Like, I can produce a horse quietly here for a couple of years, give it to Anna, she can get some nice results on the circuit out in Europe, and bang, that's job done. And so we were more and more trying to get the timing right for each horse. Yeah.
It's more individualistic.
Yeah.
Or customised.
And maybe I'm a better judge now, because I can see the big one that needs that bit more time, or the green one, or the sharp one that needs just to be put on the back, the kind of there, and let it just work away for a while with the young lad, and then we bring it in when it's settled down a bit or whatever. And if you trust your instinct and you believe in the quality, then that's the thing. And also you're trying to protect the soundness, because that's it, of mind and body of the horse. Yeah, because you can fry their brain by going too hard, too fast, and you can, and some horses can take it. Don't get me wrong. A lot of horses can take it, the pressure and work on it. But for sure, you're protecting your own asset. There's no doubt about it. Like if you call it a business, and like. I call, like, the when I first met Natasha, my partner, she said to me, I'm looking for a man with money. And I went, okay. Well, I said, I don't have a lot of money, but I've got a lot of horses.
Yeah.
And she went, okay, well, we'll see what that means. And so luckily that worked out. But anyway, but it's the same, because for me, a man with horses is, it is your money. That is your bank. That is your investment.
Your literal stock.
Yeah. Mm. And so it's I'm obliged, to, if I want to be successful, to look after it.
Yeah.
And so therefore, the more I've gone on, the more I realise that I have to protect it. So I have to produce it and give it time to grow, and I have to give it and get the moment correct for to make the sales correct, and also that the person, the people who buy off us, then have something that will last, you know, and that will be good for them and has been assessed. And we can say, yeah, this horse, we've tried it, we know it, and we believe that's going to give you the what you're looking for, what you want. And so that's the plan. And that's kind of like a plan that'll hopefully last then, if you can go at it that way.
Is there an aspect of your business or breeding program that you'd like to change or adapt here?
Change or adapt? Go on, give me, for instance.
No, I'm just wondering, you know, often it's, we have these things in our mind that are like, oh, if we sold this, we could do that, and that would allow me to do this.
Well, okay. Last year, Anna was in Centaur, and I think, what's that when you make a purchase very fast, kind of like impetuous?
Impulse.
Yeah, she kind of made an impulse purchase and bought a foal out there. And it was an Emerald Casale filly. We just got it in there now a while ago. And I think she's right, because I have to keep making some investments. As much as I say you can get in Retina and you can get in, you know, all these other mares through the semen, you do also have to bring in new blood as well. And so, and hopefully an improver. Doesn't always mean it will be, but you have to try, and there has to be a flow of stuff. Like in my riding school, we buy in new ponies every year, and there has to be a flow of stock coming through.
Yeah.
And so that is one part where I think we've got to a point where I have to maybe every year buy one or two fillies and bring in new blood to the farm. Yeah. Not necessarily, like, we're breeding off maybe about 10 or 12 mares now. I don't necessarily want to get into like 30 or 40. The farm isn't that big and I don't need it. And also the logistics of what we have now is like, if I've got 10 or 12 and say 10 or 12 horse that we've bred, and the lows that we are buying one or two here and there as well. So like, say you'd end up with 14, 15. At the moment we're riding, it's like 16 horses every day. And so that's enough to do. There's me and a couple of lads, and that's and with all the other things that are going on here.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to change anything, I think is to keep bringing in new blood, yeah, and try and have the quality of it good, you know, or as good as we can, yeah.
As a rider, you've had the privilege of representing Ireland,
yeah,
at Nations Cup level.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? And can you talk me through your Nations Cup debut?
Which one was my debut? That's an interesting one. Okay, so I got a couple of golden years around, I think it was 2006, and I was riding a horse called
Concord.
Concord, yeah. Green Card was the first. I didn't do anything with him. Concord, and Concord was a horse. He wasn't big actually. When the day he arrived, I walked in the stable and I cried, man. I thought, I've bought a pony, man. Oh, what have I done? I've bought a pony. Bit of buyer's remorse going on there.
Well, at least you had a riding school here.
Yeah, well, he could have done that. But he was a hardy little buck, and he mightn't have had all the scope, but he was always a good fighter. And we got an opportunity to run. We went with the team. We did a couple of years. We did one run 1 year, and it was the first year was in... Zagreb, Prague, Zagreb, and then Athens. And then the next year we did a couple of tours. I think we were out in a place called Hamina, and we did, I think the first Nations Cup I jumped was in, that one in Hamina. Sorry, that's it. Upaya was the one we jumped before that. We're out in Finland there, okay? And Hamina, I don't even know if it's on anymore. It was beautiful, beautiful show in the... down in this town of Hamina, and it was, which is, you're very nearly in Russia there, like you're way out there beyond Stockholm is it, or Helsinki, or which one is it, I don't know, Helsinki is Finland. And the team was like maybe myself and Crumley and I think Howley and Paul, maybe, I can't remember, And okay, I know, I remember, it might have been my first one, but I remember this one, okay? I'm jumping in drama, okay? And I'm on the team, and I go into the ring, and the guy before me got creamed, okay? And they're pulling him off the floor, and they're bringing the horse out of the ring, and they're rebuilding the fences. And so there's a big delay,
yeah.
Okay? So I'm walking around my horse, and I get this kind of couple of minutes, this pregnant pause, and I'm riding around the arena, and I'm kind of looking at the crowd, and the crowd's looking at me. And I'm kind of walking around going, jeez, this is great. Like, this is what you live for. And I'm enjoying this moment. And then I kind of look up, and it looks like they're nearly ready, and the bell rings, and off you go. And I kind of, I jump around that day for one down, and in the end of the day, we came second. Okay, so it was a good, my score counted, and the second round I didn't jump. The second round was they only used three and I got dropped. Okay, so that was okay. I was actually kind of relieved. I went, okay, yeah, come on lads, you can do it. And but for me, as a competitor, I always made sure I enjoyed it. I enjoyed my shows. It's not that I wouldn't be professional, but I would always make sure that I got to know people and interacted, and that I enjoyed my show. Because it didn't last, and it did end, and the horse went lame, and that was the end of my international showdown career at that level. And I wasn't in a financial position to be able to make it happen again, because I didn't have the money to reinvest. And Jumanji went lame too, and so suddenly you found yourself, you know, you're a couple of hundred grand down, and suddenly you're, that's, how do you recover from that? And so, but the actual feeling of doing it, it was great, yeah, it was really good. It's like when it's, everybody's a friend when you're flying it like that.
So, you're a breeder?
Yeah.
You're a rider? You're an equestrian centre owner?
Yeah.
You're a HSI level 2 coach.
Yeah.
So you have seen and you are seeing the business from a kind of a wide variety of angles.
Mm-hmm.
At this moment in time, have you any concerns for the industry? Are there any things or trends or directions that it's going that you don't feel positive about, or you think we need to address?
I hate to say no. Anything, any trends that I think, like dangerous, like threats.
Non-positive directions that the industry is going in, or things that you think as a sector, either nationally or internationally, that the industry needs to address.
That's an interesting question. I don't know if I can give you an answer straight off to that.
Okay.
I know that a lot of people would talk about, you know, horse welfare. I do believe, of course, that the sport has to stay smart and has to kind of like be aware of opinion, and has to kind of like make sure that the horse, because I personally, I love the horses and then the sport. Yeah. And and so it's easy for me. And I'm not that... I love to compete, but I'm not that... I don't care. You know, whenever I jump, if I don't win, I go... And then maybe that's part of why I'm not the top competitor, because I actually don't feel the need to win all the time, okay? I'm more a guy who... I love to compete and I love to win, but... it's not a big thing for me, so I'm not driven that way. That I'll go to, I won't do everything just to win, and I'll definitely always put my horse first, and that's the way it should be, I think, you know. But there is, okay, welfare is a thing, and for sure that has to be high on the agenda for the survival of the sport, without doubt, particularly at the Olympic level or at the high levels. Like people say, oh, it's elitist and all this. And it is. But, like, you know, we don't complain about that when they buy our horses. And so you have to take the good with the bad.
But on the flip of that, you run a writing school here.
Yep.
And I'm sure, even without knowing who comes in and out, I'm sure you have a wide range of kids and adults that come in here
yep.
from all different levels of
yep.
whatever
absolutely.
Financial background.
The access
are.
Is yeah. open, yeah. Yeah, well, we have here in Broadmeadows, I think the ethos is that we'd like to keep it accessible. And I hopefully we'll try and keep, as long as I'm here, we'll try and keep that going. Because the writing school is a strong part of the business, don't get me wrong. It's a very good part of the business here. But also, it gives an access to everybody and makes the thing open. And also, at the end of the day, it's the beginning place where people start. And it's like, mm-hmm. like a lot of my writers have come from the writing school or come from the livery yard, you know, like... If you look at, say, like Liam or yeah. if you look at Mark Kinsler over in America, he yeah. came from the writing school. And now I've got like a young lad called Craig and Luigi. He kind of came in to work as a working student in the place. So like people, it is a place. And then loads of other people who've gone into various other places. Like I've got a girl who works with called Shannon. She came from the writing school now and she was off all over the world working with all these writers. And so like not just the writers. But like we have an RDA here, we have a couple of RDAs, so there's access for people with disabilities and stuff like that, and that's important. And so it's not just about the at the very, very top level, and that's important as well, because I think the whole thing has to survive on, it has to be an openness, because the thing is, and that's what's missed is what a horse can give to you, like, is what this contact does. Well, because when you see the contact that the children get, say like our disabled children, or then even just our riding school kids, you see them get out of the car, you see them running across the things, trying, who am I on today? Snoopy, yay! And they go running in, jump on this pony, like, and. That's very important, and as well to the survival of the sport. So if you go into the pony jumping or if you go into the amateur jumping, the actual top level, maybe it'll survive without it, but maybe it won't, because it needs that public support. It needs that everybody realizes the value that the horses give to everybody.
Seeing what the ponies and horses do for kids, either kids that don't have, say kids that don't have access
yep.
to all the time.
Wouldn't have a chance to own them.
Does that enhance your appreciation for the privilege of getting to work with them full time?
The horse themselves?
The horses.
Yeah, like I suppose if you didn't have it here, you wouldn't know. It wouldn't make a difference. And In Broadmeadows, it kind of works. Everything is kind of side by side. So, like, it's kind of intermingling. But, like, when Keane was based here, like, Keane used to be, like, Keane was walking around here at Water for Chris, little kids running around, ponies and flying around all over the place. And he just worked his way around. And, like, Keane was great because he was cool. He'd just ride his horse around, whatever. And, like, you can be that close. And it doesn't have to be that way. And, of course, you know, there's the elitist part of the sport wants to separate away, but having a little riding school, like I've been in places where, like in Arezzo, they had a little riding school stuck away in the corner as well, and in other places, it's kind of amazing what you'll see. And is it essential? It is essential, because you've got to start somewhere, and not everybody can start on grade A 14-2 jumping one.
Yeah,
yeah, and so it is essential because a lot of the talent, a lot of people will come, and a lot of the support for our sport is going to come from those people. Yeah.
My final question.
Go on.
At the end of it all, what advice would you offer to a young breeder or to someone at the start of their breeding program?
Yeah. Okay. I think if you're going to look at getting into breeding, you have to look at your own circumstances to make sure that you either have a way of sustaining it while it doesn't sustain itself, or that you do it in a way like that it can. So if you're only breeding, you've got to get out fast. And because you've got to be able to turn the money over, or how are you going to live? And
by getting out fast, you mean selling as full, yeah, selling as,
yeah,
as possible.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Whereas if you have, like, okay, I've got the riding school, I've got the business here, so I can wait. And, okay, when I get to a certain point, then now, at this stage, when you have 7 and 8 year olds or whatever, and foals, you don't feel the delay, because you're selling every year anyway. And suddenly it's a production. But to get to that, there's a long time. So if you want to be a producer like that, the longer you wait, the more you have to be able to sustain it in the beginning, for sure. So I would say to breeders, they've got to look at, not that you have to have an alternative, but at the beginning, you have to be able to live while it grows. That's what I would think anyway. And don't get into it unless you're 100% passionate about it. Don't do it. Don't even go near it. Like, you're gonna get burnt, and it won't last. And I suppose at the end of the day, from my experience, and my story was when I started and made a failure of it at the beginning, maybe that's gonna happen. I don't know. Maybe that's until you know what a good horse is, or you could even buy some what look good on paper mares and mightn't be good mares. It's still, there's no sure thing. So if you're going to do it, you have to make a decision. Because I know myself, I've kind of made a decision, this is what I'm going to do. And I accept that part of that is going to be failure. And there will be, in the field, there's going to be bad ones. Or there's going to be ones that won't make a profit. There's going to be ones that are going to die. Or there's going to be things that are going to... And if you go into it, you have to accept that there's going to be failure. And there might be sometimes failure. If you only have one mare, then you've got 100% risk of total failure every year. Okay? And if you've got two, well, then you're down to 50%. And so you should have some numbers to alleviate the risk. Mm-hmm. But you also have to accept that that's going to be part of it. And don't think it's just going to, I bought a really good mare and I put the regos down, I'm just going to make money. It's not going to be like that, I think. Maybe for the odd person.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of the previous episodes, why not send it to a friend or share it on your social media?